Welcome back to the Classics Podcast and a very special episode. Part one of an interview and Q&A series with our very own expert in residence, Han Parker. Our experts in residence are classicists who love to engage, entertain, and inform a diverse audience about the ancient world. Now, Han, perhaps better known to you as Historical Han, shares her love for everything historic on social media, and she's amassed a following of almost 100,000 people on Instagram, 300,000 on TikTok, where her content has gathered 26.6 million likes, which is an unbelievable number. Han, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being our inaugural expert in residence. And it must have been an incredibly busy few years for you, bringing all of this social media audience together alongside your degrees. Just give us a little insight into what's been going on with you the past couple of years.
Wow, so much has gone on. And honestly, this is one of my favorite opportunities that I've been given so far. Such an honor to be included in your amazing organization. So the past few years have been crazy, like you said, lots of things to be done. And obviously, the degrees are the big part of it. Literally just got an email as I was about to join this meeting about reminding me to submit my thesis stuff. So Still getting a bit nervous on that front.
How's it going with the thesis then? So you're coming up to completion. How's that going at the moment?
I don't think that we're that close to completion, really. Academics like to put things off, right? So as a sort of academic in training, I think I've got that one nailed.
Great to know. Yep, you're primed for future academia.
There's been a lot of work over the past few months, especially last 6 months, and I've just kind of had to keep putting things on hold. But luckily, my department at Nottingham have been incredibly supportive of what I've been up to, and it's all right to extend. It's all right.
And so this is for your master's, because I believe you did your first degree at Nottingham as well, didn't you?
Yeah, so I'm doing a master's in research in archaeology. So I don't have any modules left, luckily, but I have got a very scary 20,000 word thesis to write.
I'm sure the problem with these things, though, is always having too many words, right? Not enough? Or is it still at that stage of creation?
Because what I research is so niche and so under-researched, it's a little bit difficult. So we're on two little words at the minute, but I'll work on it. Next time we speak, I'll hopefully have a lot more.
Yeah, let's hope that all the questions that come in on for our next Q&A session aren't about, have you finished that dissertation yet? Yeah, I'm sure you will have done so. So tell us a bit about the topic, though, that you're writing about. You said it's very niche.
Yes, so I am researching basically the role of the ancient Greek goddess Tyche, but in the Roman Near East, because she takes on a very specific context. So in ancient Greece, she's a fortune goddess, just the equivalent of the Roman goddess Fortuna. But in the Near East, she's got this very unique role as being a city personification. So pretty much every city in the Roman Near East has their own Tyche. And there are three main sort of trend-setting Tyches. So the Tyche of Antioch is one of them, and the sort of cities around that main Tyche do spin-offs, so versions of her, but they're very specific to them. And my sort of research is looking at how specific they make them. Samosata, for example, swaps out the river personification for a Pegasus, or how Palmyra obviously doesn't have a river flowing through her, but she has got a spring, so that's personified as a woman rather than a man. And there's this indigenous idea of Gad, and Gad are sort of local fortune things. And these deities were on tokens in places like Palmyra, and they're associated with tribes and families. But then at somewhere like Gyrrhiopis, which is a frontier city on the Euphrates, they have Tyches being described as gads next to gads, and then Tyches being swapped out as gads. So swapping between male and female in the same city. So I'm sort of looking at this local idea of gad and how the role that that took in making Tyche, this imported goddess, their own thing.
It's amazing actually when you think about how, the impact of different cultures within the ancient world, that often we're seeing similar ideas expressed but just in different forms, some indigenous, some imported, as you say, from different cultures. How do you know when you're looking at evidence, particularly archaeological evidence or even art, whether you've kind of found Tyche or whether this is something from before? Are there particular visual kind of clues to her identity?
Yeah, so taikis are pretty easy to spot most of the time. I'll get in trouble for not saying taikai. They're pretty easy to spot. So very often, if not always, they'll have a turreted crown. So that represents the city's walls. She often has a cornucopia or a horn of plenty. If she's based on the Antioch type, she's pretty much always got some sort of river personification by her foot. So she'll be sort of posed in a very specific way if she's from northern Syria. So you can tell by that. Whereas a gad will often take more of a form of a local important god. So at Druropus, he's based on a version of Zeus, but he's not Zeus. He's their sort of like spin-off Zeus Tyche. It's harder to spot a gad than it is to spot a taiki. Spotting a taiki is pretty common. She's often on coins all the time. It's very hard to spot her temples often. There was a coin that was discovered. It turned up at an auction, I think, last spring, Easter time. And it was the only representation we found of the Tycheon at Antioch. And of course, it got snapped up by a private collector. So that was frustrating.
It sounds almost like the start of a proverb or a bad joke there about you can't find a gad, but you can find a taiki.
Yeah.
So with taiki, how was this something that you first got interested in? Was this from studying ancient religion? Was it from the archaeology? How did this first become an interest for you?
So it's all really thanks to my supervisor. So when I was in my third year of my undergrad, I had this incredible professor called Dr. Andreas Kropp, and he was teaching a module called From Petra to Palmyra, which sort of opened my eyes to the Roman Near East. And I became quite obsessed with his line of work, which was Palmyra portraits. And I was hell-bent on my emres being on frontality, which was my sort of first obsession with the Near East. And I had my first meeting with my supervisors of my emres, and he said, "You know, this is a PhD topic. This is too much. Why don't you do Tyche?" Because he's done lots of research on Tyche. And he was sort of like, "You know, I'm focused on this other stuff, but this is really interesting." So me and Tyche, we had a bit of a, we sort of chucked together thanks to my supervisor. And I was maybe not so pleased about it at the time because I'd spent the whole summer obsessing over a certain topic. But then I just sort of became a bit obsessed with her myself.
I'm not surprised. No, it's such an interesting topic. So you mentioned Palmyra there, and you've mentioned northern Syria as well. So how are these places, which obviously in the modern world have sort of suffered politically and the physical spaces have been so affected by modern events, how has that impacted the archaeology and what we can still find out about lots of these topics?
So that's a really good question. Fortunately, a lot of the artifacts that sort of I'm interested in has been, and most people are interested in, have been, taken from place to places like the Glyptotek in Denmark and the Yale Art Gallery. They've been sort of like taken away prior to that conflict because those were the sort of bodies that were part of the excavation 100 years ago. So rightly or wrongly, they were taken away, but that protected them unknowingly that from what was going to happen. The devastating fact is that these places hadn't been excavated completely. So, of course, there was just a wealth of material that was looted, that was bombed, completely destroyed. And of course, something that I'm particularly interested in is how we interact with art in the modern world versus how it was intended to be interacted with. So you can't walk up to a Palmyra portrait, for example, in a museum, as well as the British Museum do it with their stacked levels, even though they're from different time periods, which is a bit frustrating. We can't go and see those tower tombs anymore because they've been destroyed. And I think that that context, the buildings and the temples have been lost, is the hardest thing because, I mean, often I'm going off of archaeological reports from 100 years ago that don't tell the story in as many words as I want to be told it. It's hard to sort of picture that in your mind. And of course, we can't go out and see these places because even if we were able to get there, they aren't there to be seen. But I do just want to say, obviously, that from an archaeologist's point of view, it's horrendous what's happened. But the suffering to human life and the people that do live in those places today, that is the priority. And I think that we just have to remember when we get upset about artifacts being lost, that those people aren't around to see the suffering today. And the people that are there today are the ones that should be getting that compassion.
Yes, indeed. And it's such a different situation archaeologically from other places, for example, whether it be Pompeii and Herculaneum, somewhere like Oxyrhynchus, where we're still able to constantly discover and there's more that we know that has been preserved, and it also through a disaster, but from a much longer time ago. And that is, you know, there's still things to be uncovered. And yet we're now seeing that same process of things kind of being hidden and destroyed and then lost forever, but in a much fresher sense. So it's I guess, a different perspective, different standpoint in time, isn't it, for seeing it from an archaeological perspective?
Definitely.
Have you yourself been on many digs?
I am a fake ancient historian. I have never been on an official dig in my life. I went on a community archaeology dig. I think it was during COVID, and it was sort of nearby to where I live at home, because I was obviously with my family. And it was at Richmond Castle in North Yorkshire. And I went out in the rain for an afternoon because that was the only slot that was available. And it was a group of children, young children, and then me, my partner, and my mum. Because my dad was supposed to come, but because he doesn't live in England, the flights were delayed because of COVID, so he couldn't make it. And it was the last day of the dig, and they only had one trench that needed to be dealt with, like people still digging in. And I was all excited, and they gave it to the kids. So of course they did. Of course they're going to try and make memories for like the 8-year-old. I'm not bitter. So I got in charge of filling in a trench that another family had done another day. And I was quite irritated because it was absolutely tipping it down and, you know, really, really not happy. And then I found something. Yeah, so someone had actually missed a piece of Humberware. So I think that's some medieval green glazed pottery. And I sort of plucked it out and I went and showed the archaeologists, and they were really impressed. And after that, they let me help clean up some of the stuff they'd found. So I was quite happy. I won some favours with them.
Gold star for hand.
Thank you.
Well, I'm glad there was a positive end to that story. But it sounds like, yeah, sounds like we're going to have to get you on some other digs elsewhere, perhaps beyond the UK, as time goes on. I mean, growing up in North Yorkshire, what was your first encounter with the ancient world and with history, and how did your interest develop?
Yeah, so I felt like I've misled you a little bit. I didn't grow up in England. I grew up in Saudi Arabia.
Ah.
So my connections with history go back to my grandmother. So she was a Plantagenet historian who ran away with her boyfriend when she was in her 20s to Zambia, unmarried, you know, after getting her degree from Durham. So she obviously left all that behind, but she was still obsessed with reading. And when she came to visit us, we'd often meet up in England and she'd take us to castles and all this. And then I sort of had this like childhood obsession with every sort of period of history, like the Tudors, the Victorians, like, you know, dressed up like a little Victorian child worker for school, that kind of thing. And then I went to sort of like secondary school and I hated history. I absolutely hated history. I thought it was really boring. It was all about the Industrial Revolution. And I was lucky enough to do a bit of classics, but I didn't ever think it was a serious thing. I never thought it was a real opportunity for me. And I was quite good at it, luckily, but so I just took it for my GCSEs and I took it for my A-levels because it was kind of a banked grade. And I was very much in a school that was at that time, you know, I don't know how many years ago I was at school, but say 7 years ago, it was very much women in STEM, go and do science, go and do this, which is amazing. And luckily, because I went to uni to do environmental biology, lots of my very dear friends are scientists and they can help me when I need help. But it really just wasn't for me. And I sort of got very, I was unfortunately quite sick, and I refound my love of classics, and it sort of all went from there.
That's so interesting. And your grandma sounds like an amazing person. I know when I was a child, my favourite party trick to do was I had a playing card set of all the different kings and queens of England. And you could obviously, they all had different suits and numbers, but you could lay them out chronologically in order of all the kings and queens. And it was my little trick to go and do this. And when I was, I don't know, I was probably about 6 or 7. But just like looking at the pictures, learning about the history of each one, because they had such personalities, was something that really got me into history. So you never quite know where that interest is going to come from. And do you think from being brought up outside of the UK and then coming to study over here as well, that gave you an international sense of history, a sense of, especially when looking at the ancient world, of seeing it in you know, its many different shapes and forms.
Yeah, definitely. So I think growing, not only just growing up overseas, but coming from quite a multicultural family, like my parents weren't born in the UK. My family's never really had roots here. So we've traveled a lot. We've always been visiting family in all these different places, which it's a great way of exposing children to things that you wouldn't learn at school. So I was really fortunate to be taught all this amazing different history of every place I would go. So I've spent a lot of time in Zambia, for example, and I've got to learn about everything there. And I got to go to Spain and learn things about that. And I think that especially that element sparked my interest in sort of like cross-cultural interaction in the ancient world. I think that that idea of being somebody that didn't feel that they necessarily belonged in one place and they felt a bit of a mismatch made me see parallels in the ancient world. And I think that at the time when I was a kid, I found that that was quite a hard background to come from. But I realized the older I get that it was actually one of the greatest gifts that my parents could have given me.
And that's interesting that therefore one of your many classical interests was about frontiers as well, which I suppose in the ancient world was very much a cultural melting pot of so many different people coming often for military purposes, but then the towns and cities growing up around them, all sorts of different industries. And that's when we see different religion, and we see, for example, in Roman Britain, you know, tombstones to Syrians and Libyans and those that have travelled such a long way, especially in those days, across the then Roman Empire. Are there some of those sorts of stories that really have grabbed you? I know that these are lots of the sorts of things that you share on TikTok and in short form to kind of really give people an insight into the stories and daily lives of people in the ancient world.
Yes, so you hit the nail on the head there with the Roman Britain funerary monuments. One of my absolute favorite stories, and it's actually horrendous that I've never been and seen her, is of course Regina from South Shields. I'm sure she'd love to be known as that. So for those who are listening who don't know who Regina is, you have to look her up. She's wonderful. So she was a Celtic woman from somewhere down south near Norfolk. That might be a lie. I'm not sure, but somewhere down south. And she was a slave and she was bought by a man called Barates, and he came from Palmyra. And they eventually, he married her and freed her. And what's incredible is that her tombstone shows her wearing her Celtic clothing, which is obviously a wonderful detail for her husband to have ensured to have happened. And her inscription is both in Latin, but there's also a part in Palmyrene Aramaic. I can't not mention the amazing bread that we have from Herculaneum. I'm obsessed with this story. So on the morning likely of the eruption taking place in 79 AD, there was this slave called Keller, and he bakes this bread. He brands the bread, so it has his signature on there. It says Keller made this, and the eruption happens. And we know he was a slave, so he belonged to a man who probably owned the House of the Stags in Herculaneum. And you're thinking, well, that's real bad luck. You're stuck in this city or this town, and it was this big eruption, but he survives. Not only do we literally have the loaf of bread that he baked, we know that he survived because he was later freed.
It's actually incredible. How do we know that he was later freed?
There's a sort of like list of freed slaves after the eruption. And what's interesting that I didn't know, because I don't understand Latin or Greek, somebody told me that Keller actually means speedy. So it's kind of funny if you kind of imagine him like jogging out of Herculaneum just in time.
Yeah, truly living up to his namesake, just in the nick of time. I mean, we have quite a few, I suppose, bread references when it comes to Pompeii and Herculaneum, and the recent fresco found as well, which people argued looked a bit like a pizza. Not necessarily a pizza that the Romans would have had. Did you like that one too?
I did like that one, and I was amazed at how popular that story was. It really did break the headlines, but I was sort of like, guys, it's not a pizza. It's a flatbread. It's not, it's what it is. And but people were not having it. It's like sometimes there is a discovery that you, no matter how much you put out the truth, people are never going to believe you. They're just too in love with the idea that the Romans had pizza. So, I just kind of had to let that one slide. But it's a beautiful fresco.
It really is, as are so many throughout the vivacity and the sort of vibrant colours that still can shine through so clearly. I mean, tell everyone to go and visit Pompeii and Herculaneum if they possibly can, because it's and also there's so many sort of online tours and think ways in which you can see them. But the frescoes are one thing that they're so kind of haunting, I find, and eerie when you're there to have such vivid colours in amongst kind of destruction that's still sort of visible in that way that it's obvious that those things still stand and remain. It's very powerful. So another aspect of, I think, your sort of approach to history has been focusing on female stories. And obviously you've already spoken about your thesis about the goddess Tyche. How important is feminism, I suppose, to you as a historian?
I think that you can't even be a historian nowadays without really having that at the forefront of your mind when you're looking at these stories. I think so. Currently, I'm writing my first book, and it's sort of about women. I don't think I can say too much, but
Oh, don't say too much, but that is an exciting drop in itself, listeners.
yeah. And I was actually researching some stuff about Etruscan women today, and the amazing sort of like freedom that they had in comparison to places like in Athens. And I think that historians, historically, both in the ancient world and today, have viewed women through a certain lens. And I think it's very important that we have women, like female historians, coming forward and men who were feminists coming forward and reanalyzing these stories instead of just letting them stay in the narrative that they have been. And I think that, this, it's just like with Suetonius, there's so much slander. It's not real. It's one person's view or a slanderous view. And I think that in reality, so many women, everyday women, empresses, queens throughout history played such an important role in the world that we have today, in shaping the world we have today. There's so many women throughout history that have really changed the world as we know it. And I just think that we can't do these women justice if we don't give them a chance. And I think a lot of the time in the past, people haven't. And I'm so glad that we have some amazing female historians and writers today really telling their stories. And I love it. And also the historical fictions that are coming out. They're a bit of a love-hate thing for me as an individual, but they're so important in getting people excited about history and learning about these women and these women's stories. Prime example is Elodie Harper's The Wolf Den. There are so many stories like this that are finally getting people excited.
Exactly, and stories that are there to be told, and sometimes there's very little evidence on which we can go, and obviously that's the power also of an author to be able to bring that to life and to use historical context and knowledge as well to give that all of the correct grounding. And others whose stories have been there the whole time, they've just been ignored, or they've just been shaped in a particular narrative, as you say, and it's great for them to be brought to the fore.
Absolutely.
Before you mentioned about things going viral. So how was it that you yourself came to go viral, as it were? Because 26.6 million likes on TikTok, that doesn't just happen without some great content and some great ideas. So tell us a bit about how you kind of got into content creation in the first place.
Well, the thing is everybody will always say they never expected anything to happen with social media. And honestly, that is the truth. During COVID lockdown, I was very obsessed with sort of the classics community on Instagram. And I made a really, really great friend who's in Australia on there. And she creates videos for World History Encyclopedia. And she sort of said to me, she's like, Hannah, you could easily do this. You should start a YouTube. So I did. And then I went back to uni and I was like, you know what, YouTube just isn't for me. I can't, I find it too awkward to just look at myself editing for like half an hour. I was like, I can't do this. So then I reluctantly downloaded TikTok. So I thought, I can do what I want to do, short form content, but without all these people from school following me on my Instagram. So I did that as a sort of secret way for me to make my history nerd videos. And I sort of dallied about with it sort of like once every few months or once a week or whatever, very sporadically. When I started my MRes, so that was in September 2022. It's been going on a long time. I decided to post a bit more regularly. I was in France and I thought, I'm in these amazing archaeological sites. Let's post every day. And then I started the archaeology news videos and that just took off. People loved them, which was crazy. Then people loved my sort of little skits about women in the ancient world doing something that we still do today, which was wonderful. You know, people seeing parallels with the people that came before them. And also the sad dog videos, the sad cat videos, people love that. If there's anything to learn from me as a case study, it's people prefer a sad video than a happy one. I'm telling you, that's the key to success.
It must be so exciting when you see all the kind of the likes and the reposts and the shares coming in overnight, as it were, especially when it's from across the world. How does that then affect, I suppose, the way that you're thinking about using classics and how it's a form of life, your work, your study, but also potentially a career and a way of transmitting that to other people?
Yeah, so I'm not gonna lie, when you have video go viral, it is scary, because I had this wonderful friend on social media tell me that if a video hits 100,000 views and you have 100,000 followers, that's when you're going to start to have nasty comments. So that is absolutely true. And I've had quite a few videos that have been, you know, over the million now, luckily. And it's definitely true. But I suppose I sort of console myself with the idea that the views make me money. So it's okay if people are nasty, because they're giving me a bit of money, so it's okay.
And for every very small percentage of people, I suppose, that's saying something nasty, there's all the other people that are enjoying your content and knowing that, you know, you're having a positive impact at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly rewarding when I get messages. I get quite a lot of messages and emails from sort of teenagers that are sort of starting their love with history, their sort of careers with history. And honestly, that is just the most wonderful feeling when you get messages saying, you've inspired me to go to uni to do this, or would you mind answering a few questions about this topic, or can you recommend me a book please, and all this. And you kind of realize that, oh my gosh, I've influenced these people to do what I love. And those people are then going to go and influence people to do what they love. And then you have this like by effect that all these people are going to do history just because you made a video. If I can make one person fall in love with history, that's worth every mean comment.
If you'd like to meet Han and the rest of the CA team, then come along to the CA annual conference held this year at the University of Warwick on the 22nd to the 24th of March. You can catch up with all the latest in classics, academia and pedagogy across more than 50 panels and workshops, as well as enjoy prize givings, receptions and exclusive performances, including from our honorary president, the poet and translator Anne Carson. There's also keynote lectures from Yanis Hamalakis on the Acropolis and from the winners of our Young Speaker competition. To find out more, go to classicalassociation.org/conference. Tickets start from just £28 a day, and we look forward to seeing you there. So Han, one thing that you often share with us on your social media is you give us a bookshelf tour, and I know that you love books, your room has many books in it. What's on your TBR pile at the moment, or some things that you've read recently that you would recommend?
So I have to recommend this wonderful book that I've been using as my sort of travel book whenever I go down to London, which is Hidden Heritage: Rediscovering Britain's Relationship with the Orient. And I know that that's not a classical book, but as somebody who doesn't really know anything about British history past Boudicca, I have to recommend that because it's absolutely brilliant. It's the first book I've read in years that I've said everybody should read this book. So okay. I had to say it.
Message understood. Thank you.
If I could recommend three books to everybody out there based on my preferences, going on what book is my sort of Bible for my thesis is Roman Syria in the Near East by Kevin Butcher. That was my course book for Petra to Palmyra. And I stumbled into Barter Books in Alnwick in Northumberland, and it was £11 and it's a hardback. So obviously I snapped that straight up, and it is literally the book if you're interested in that part of the world. I would always recommend it. And then my other two would be, I love art history. I would say that by default, I'm an ancient art historian. That's kind of what I would tell people. And I really love a book called The Art of Painting in Ancient Greece by Dimitris Plantsos. I've definitely butchered that name, but it's a great book, and it tells you the whole timeline of painting in the ancient Greek world. And it talks about sort of like the paintings from Roman Egypt, the sort of mummy portraits, which we haven't talked about, but I'm absolutely obsessed with. And it talks about Pompeii and the incredible frescoes. And I actually think that if you only wanted one book about painting in the ancient world, that's the only book you would need.
Fantastic. That sounds perfect. And is there a third one?
Yes. So I, again, for art history, I love anything by John Boardman. I think that he is an incredible writer, and he really does make in-depth stories sound interesting. I think sometimes when you're reading academic works, it drags on, but I love his books. And my favorite one of his so far is The Greeks in Asia, because I'm really, really interested in the sort of overlap in cultural, cross-cultural interaction and that sort of impact on art, especially somewhere like Gandhara. And my favorite thing about that sort of part of the world is that Tyche, as a city personification, is actually continued into ancient northern India and Gandhara, where she becomes a different goddess, but she still has a horn of plenty, except there you can't have a horn because horns were sacred. So it sort of becomes like a plant bundle. So it's really interesting how he shows that sort of transition across geography.
Yeah, I think John Boardman is a god. He's divine within.
He is.
Greek club classical vase painting and sculpture and pottery and so much more. And as you say, I know the Classical Art Research Centre in Oxford, where he was based, as well as the Sir John Beazley originally, they did a whole series, didn't they, on Gandhara, the Gandhara connection. So I think there's lots of resources you can find online of those, which we can link in the description, because it's just so fascinating, and the different types and forms of art that you see that, you know, within India and then the Greek Near East as well. It's fantastic. So Han, if you were able to speak to three people and perhaps invite them to dinner from the ancient world, who would be the three that you would pick?
Okay, I'm pretty on it with this one. So number one, I would have to invite Caligula. Not because, well, I'm a bit of a Caligula apologist, but it's solely because I have to introduce him to my cat, who I named after him. Because I think that he would love that his Little Boots nickname had been given to my cat, who had little white socks. I think he'd like that. no other reason. My second one would be, I would love to invite the Spartan princess Kaniska. She won an Olympic, you know, won at the Olympics, and she was the only woman to have won at the Olympics in the ancient world. Not because she actually participated, but that she paid for her horses to be ridden in the race. So I think I'd love to show her how women are today, and I think she'd like to see the role that women play in the Olympics. So maybe I'd schedule it to have this dinner when the Paris Olympics were taking place. I think she'd like to watch them.
Perfect. Yes.
And my final person is everybody has a figure from the ancient world that they love and hate. They have a real relationship with. And for me, that's Hadrian. And he, when I was doing my undergrad dissertation, I actually had dreams about Hadrian. And that's a bit embarrassing to admit, but his, like, I was doing a lot of sort of like analysis of his decor and the deep meanings his decor had. And I think that I just want to ask him, are my hypotheses like true, or am I really reaching too far here? Because I need to know if you really intended that crocodile statue there to be for a very specific reason, or if I'm being crazy. But also, he loved a good party, and I think that he would just have like the conversation and the wine flowing, and I think we'd get on.
Yeah, I think you'd be a top party guest. And you know, you've got to get from the horse's mouth as to whether your hypotheses are correct. I think you know, no good asking any imperial artists or anybody else. You need to ask the man himself. Those are three great choices. And also, just for Caligula and Hadrian to meet as well, to kind of have a proper Roman emperor crossover across a century, and to see what they made of each other.
I don't think Hadrian would have liked it.
No, I don't think so. Fantastic. I love it. Well, that brings us on to our final question, which is one that we ask all of our podcast guests, and that is about the idea, place, person, concept that resonates with you the most from the ancient world.
I am very lucky to have visited quite a few ancient sites. But I, last summer, I went to Sparta for the first time. And I have no real interest in Sparta. And I know it's like a horrible thing to say, and I know you're all gasping, but like, I kind of think of Sparta as being this like military thing. And I know it wasn't just that, but that sort of, I was never bothered. And we went to this place called the Menelaon. We were at a conference and we kind of skived off the afternoon session to go to the Menelaon. And we drove up this road, this dirt mountain road. And we stood at the top in these ruins, and these ruins are like thousands of years old. I mean, something has been there since like the Bronze Age. And I just looked out over that mountain, and you could see Sparta, and you can see everything, and these beautiful mountains are framing it. And it was sort of like early summer, and there were flowers everywhere. And I just, honest to God, I just felt so at home. I've never felt that way anywhere. And it was so strange. And I don't know. There's something about Sparta. I think if you haven't been, you don't get it. But it's really, a really special place. And there's no other reason for it. And then the afternoon, we went to the museum and they have a Tyche. So, you know, I'm telling you that she brings me good luck.
I think she was looking down upon you in Sparta and giving you a taste of that good fortune.
Definitely.
Thank you so much, Han. That is the first part of our two-part episode. So if you're listening now, then please go away and come and ask Han all of the questions that you might have, because we've just scratched the surface today. And I know that she's keen, as our expert in residence, to answer all of your questions. So head to the description or head to our website, classicalassociation.org/expert-in-residence, where you'll find a form where you can drop your questions. Check them out on social media too. Make sure you're following us at the Classical Pod on Instagram. And Han,
at Hannah_Parker_ and on TikTok at historical_Han_.
Thank you so much, Han, for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me.